From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tonight, NBC previews the new comedy series, The New Normal, about a gay couple that wants to have a child and hires a surrogate. We'll talk with one of the stars of the show, Andrew Rannells, who also starred in the original Broadway production of The Book of Mormon. Rannells says he knew he was gay by the time he was 4, when he really liked one of the actors in the film Grease 2.
Not like I wanted to be him, like I wanted to date him.
But Rannells waited until graduating from high school to come out to his family.
And, you know, so when I came out, I surprised 0 people in my family. There's not a surprise to be had. No, everybody was well aware of that.
And Ed Ward tells the story behind one of the forgotten recording studios in Memphis. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight, NBC will preview the first episode of its new comedy series, The New Normal. My guest is one of the stars, Andrew Rannells, who was also the star of the original Broadway production of The Book of Mormon.
Hello. My name is Elder Price, and I would like to share with you the most amazing book.
Rannells left The Book of Mormon when he got the part in The New Normal. You may know him from his role in the HBO series Girls. He played Lena Dunham's college boyfriend, who she learns is gay. In The New Normal, Rannells stars with Justin Bartha as a gay couple. They decide they're ready to have a child, so they hire a surrogate. Rannells' character, Brian Collins, is a TV producer loosely based on Ryan Murphy, the co-creator of The New Normal. Murphy also co-created Glee and created Nip Tuck. Here's a scene from the first episode of The New Normal. Rannells and Bartha are sitting on a bench in the park, watching parents with their children. Bartha speaks first.
You really think it's such a good idea to bring a kid into the world with such a non-traditional family?
I know somebody else from a non-traditional family. A African-American who was raised by a grandma. And that person seems to be doing just fine.
Oh, yeah. Barack Obama.
No, Mariah Carey. But your example works, too.
Andrew Rannells, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the new series. So if your character is based on the creator of the show, Ryan Murphy, who also created Glee, do you, like, study him? Does he want you to play him?
Well, luckily, no, because if I had to do an impersonation of Ryan, I think I would be terrified on a daily basis. But lucky for me, when I first met with Ryan, before the New Normal sort of came about, we realized very quickly that I think we had a lot in common, and I realized that, like, our senses of humor was very similar. He's from Indiana, I'm from Nebraska, we were both raised Catholic, we both moved to, you know, big cities sort of as soon as we could, and we just had a lot in common, and I think that there was a dryness to both of our senses of humor that we just had in common. So the writing, it feels like it's, you know, as much as it's being written sort of, you know, as Ryan Murphy, it feels really well written for me. So it feels pretty natural to say some of the things that I say and do a lot of the things that I do.
So your partner on the show is played by Justin Bartha. And
yes.
You are more theatrical than he is and more into, like, clothing and shopping and, and, you know, joking and everything. So how did you figure out how to play your role so that it wouldn't kind of cross the line into stereotype?
Yeah, yeah. It's tricky because you don't – I certainly didn't want to be gay clown on this, you know, because the subject matter is actually a really sweet one and a really I think a really lovely one about these people who are so in love and so committed to each other that they realize that what's missing in their life is to share that love with a child. So it's a rather serious and loving subject matter. So I didn't want to, you know, dumb it down or with sort of stereotypical over the top gay flash and sass. So luckily the writing coming from Ryan Murphy and from Ali Adler and all of our wonderful writers really allows me to sort of, like, play a little bit of that. But I think the more sort of straightforward you play all those jokes, particularly the flamboyant ones, the more it just sort of becomes a character trait and not a joke, if that makes any sense. Like, it just becomes, you know, something sort of ingrained in this guy and not a put-on idea to get a laugh. And I've been really lucky, particularly moving forward with these scripts, that there's just been more and more of that, and I feel like the characters just sort of get richer and more sort of human as we go along.
So I don't know much about Justin Bartha, but I read someplace that he's straight. Does that matter?
He is straight. You know, at first, I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure if it was going to matter. I'm gay, so I felt like, you know, there's a, you know, I enjoyed the fact that I actually, you know, being homosexual, got to play a homosexual. And so often you see, you know, straight actors playing gay actors and people talk about how brave they are to play, you know,
right,
homosexuals. And it's like, oh, Jesus, really? That it's such, like, a, you know, this, they're doing something so, you know, revelatory. But not with Justin. I don't know. Justin just did it. There was not much of a conversation about it. There remains not to be much of a conversation about it. He just sort of does it, which is really great. And it's not, he's not looking for, like, a pat on the back or isn't this great that I'm, you know, taking a risk as an actor and playing a, you know, homosexual. He just is doing it because it's a great part. So that's been fantastic.
Are you hoping that this show will help convince mainstream audiences who aren't already convinced that gay people can make great parents?
I hope so. I mean, I hope that, and certainly, you know, I think that, you know, Modern Family has done a really fantastic job. Jesse Tyler Ferguson and Eric Stone Street's characters have really done a great job, I think, of opening a lot of eyes to how normal, quote unquote, like, you know, gay couples are, and like, well, they're just like us. And if this is the next part of that, to show sort of, you know, the beginnings of that relationship and also the beginning of the family and what exactly, you know, gay couples have to go through to start a family, because it's not an easy process. It's an expensive process and it's a lengthy process, and it doesn't always work. And I think it's exciting to get to sort of show that for, you know, one of the first times on television, I think is exciting. My sister Becky in Omaha recently said that she coined the phrase swing straights, that she thought that, like, after watching this pilot, she was like, I think this will, you know, potentially sway some folks who don't think they have anything in common with gay people, or they don't know any gay people, or this could potentially change some minds. So Becky Britt in Omaha, Nebraska, you know, swing straights, which I think that's a great term.
Very good. Very good. Network standards. Are network standards any different for gay characters than they are for straight characters when it comes to embraces and the bedroom?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because I didn't think so. And we have not, to my knowledge, come up against any, there haven't been any questions. And, you know, Justin and I, there's a scene in our pilot that where Justin and I are, you know, we are in bed and we kiss, and it's actually a really loving moment about when we decide who is going to be the biological father of this child that we're creating. And nobody ever said anything about it, you know, as far as I know, at the network or standards and practices or anything. But then yesterday I was recording the show on my DVR, just sort of, you know, scrolling through, because it airs, you know, on the next week, and so I was recording it, and I noticed that in the description it said intense sexual situations, which I thought was very odd. I mean, it said, like, you know, strong adult humor or something, which, you know, it does skew, you know, I suppose, in that direction, but intense sexual situations, I thought that was odd, and I wanted to ask Ryan and Allie about that, about if they had, you know, and I'm not sure if that's for everything, if that's, you know, if that's included on, you know, Desperate Housewives, is that on, you know, the description of Grey's Anatomy, or was that because it's too gay men kissing? I don't know. I mean, we're not on a cable network, we're on NBC, so there's not, and we're not setting out to do an intense sexual show. That's just not the story we're telling, but it will be interesting to see sort of what the reception is of just, you know, simple physical contact, or, you know, little intimacies.
So Ellen Barkin plays the grandmother of the woman who becomes your surrogate. And Ellen Barkin, at least in the first episode of The New Normal, she's just, like, racist and homophobic. She's got a bad word for everybody.
And yeah, she's an equal opportunity.
Yeah, and there's one, I mean, I thought it was a funny joke. She sees what she thinks are two men walking down the street with a baby, and she thinks, like, that's disgusting, like, two men with a baby, like, they shouldn't be parents like that. And then her daughter says to her, Mom, they're lesbians.
Yes.
And so... I wonder if there's, like, a homophobic joke that strikes you as the funniest of the homophobic jokes in the pilot.
In the pilot.
Or further in.
She at one point calls Justin and I salami smokers, which is, you know, so ridiculous, but kind of hilarious. And what's better, I think, is that Ryan let me react rather honestly to that, which I said, I was like, oh, that's a good one. which it was a last minute change in the script, and that's what came out of my mouth when she said it. So he let me say that in the pilot. Oh, that's a good one. Because I think that particularly, like, as a you know, as a gay man, I've heard like all, I feel like I've heard them all at this point. So you have to have a certain sense of humor about it, I suppose. But our writers do come up with really creative ways to offend lots of people. So as the scripts keep coming in, it's, I think we're all still regularly surprised. Even Ellen, that, you know, that she's gets to say some of the things that she's going to say.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Rannells, and he stars in the new NBC series, The New Normal, about a gay couple who hires a surrogate so that they can have a child. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more, okay, including talking about the Book of Mormon.
Sounds good.
This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Rannells. He stars in the new NBC comedy series, The New Normal. And he starred in the Book of Mormon. He just left the show in June in order to do The New Normal. Andrew Rannells, that show was so good. And you were so terrific in it. I was lucky enough to see you in the show. And so before we go any further, I want to play something from the cast recording with you singing. And I thought we'd hear I Believe. I Believe is a parody of songs that are anthems of affirmation. Tell us what you think of this song and what songs you were thinking of when you sang it, or what songs you think Trey Parker and Matt Stone were thinking of when they co-wrote it.
Sure. The song that I think Trey sort of explained with the, particularly the opening of I Believe is sort of a tribute to I Have Confidence from The Sound of Music, where Julie Andrews is leaving the convent to go, you know, be the nanny to the Von Trapps. And so that was sort of always in my head. But as I sort of worked on it more, it is there's sort of a Disney-esque quality to it. It's usually like the Disney heroine has a moment of singing a song that she's sort of affirming her own belief, or her own belief in herself normally is what the song is. So I absolutely loved singing it every night. It was my favorite part of doing the show was getting out there and belting that song out.
And talk a little bit about the lyric.
The lyric is all Trey and Bob, Trey and Parker and Matt Stone and Bobby Lopez like to remind everyone that the chorus of the song lists facts from the Book of Mormon. Sort of the fundamental beliefs of the Mormon Church are listed, but in sort of a 1-2-3, you know, punch joke format. But they are all true. There's no joke in I Believe, Trey liked to tell people.
Okay, so this is my guest, Andrew Rannells, from the original cast recording of the Book of Mormon.
You cannot just believe partway. You have to believe in it all. My problem was doubting the Lord's will instead of standing tall. I can't allow myself to have any doubt. It's time to set my worries free. Time to show the world what Elder Price is about and share the power inside of me.
Believe.
Just
I know that
That's Andrew Reynolds from the cast recording of the Book of Mormon. So what reaction would you get to that song every night?
I mean, as a performer, it was always a really thrilling thing to do because it was, I think, the audience sort of, they enjoyed it. I think it was a great moment, I think, in the story and also sort of an unexpected moment for my character to sort of, you know, rebound with that much belief in his faith. So, yeah, the response was always very exciting. And then, so I think it was, you know, I got to perform that song at the Tony Awards, which was, a huge, huge thrill for me. And it's such an honor to get to represent our show like that. And after that, it became sort of like the song from the Tonys. So, for a few months after that, I would start to sing it and I would hear, people in the audience like, this is the one from them. This is what he sang on the Tonys. So it was exciting. It took on sort of a different meaning for people. My mother has really been getting a kick out of, with Mitt Romney running for president, on a lot of news programs, they show clips of me singing, particularly that verse about in 1978, God changed his mind about black people. People like to play that on like news magazine shows. So she really likes to see that. Oh, they talked about Mitt Romney and they showed that clip of you singing. It's nice to be so closely linked.
along similar lines, Newsweek had a cover where was you on the poster for the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, it was my body and Mitt's head.
And Mitt Romney's head. Yeah, which was odd. Did they ask you for permission? Did they tell you in advance that was going to happen?
They must have asked someone. They didn't ask me. They didn't need to ask me, but they must have.
So how'd you find out?
I'm sure. It appeared in my dressing room. One of our publicity department for the Book of Mormon gave me a copy of it, and they said that you are sort of on the cover of Newsweek. No one knows it's you except for you, but yeah, there you are on the cover of Newsweek.
So, were you a fan of Trey Parker and Matt Stone's South Park?
Huge, huge fan of that. I believe it started like my senior year of high school or something, or maybe my junior year of high school. And I just, I went to an all boys Catholic high school. So needless to say, it was like, nuts. Like everybody knew what that was. Everybody was watching that. And the movies were so funny and Team America was so great. And they were such the crazy personalities, going to the Oscars dressed as Gwyneth Paltrow and Jennifer Lopez, like they're so bizarre and they just seem so larger than life, and I never would have expected to get the chance to work with them, but was so thrilling to do so.
So you left the show in June, and I imagine that was in order to start the new normal. Were you ready to leave the show, and had you gotten tired of it? I always wonder, no matter how wonderful a show is, if you get tired of doing it every night.
Yeah, I mean, there's a level of, I think we did close to like 500 performances by the time that I left, which is, that's a lot. That's a lot 8 times a week, and it really takes over your whole life, and it affects everything. It affects how you sleep and when you eat and when you go to the gym, and it takes over everything. But at the same time, there was such a sense of ownership of the role and of the show that I felt so responsible for presenting it every night that I can't ever say that I got sick of it. And I've never felt that doing a live show. I felt like it was somehow important, and that I needed to present this to the audience every night. So it was always always truly a joy to do it every night. But there does come a time where you don't want to overstay your welcome, and it started to become something larger with a tour and then a company in Chicago, and they're talking about a company in London, and it started to get bigger. And I think that Josh Gad and I both sort of felt like that was kind of the natural time to maybe move on to our next project, as the show sort of graduated into something larger. And luckily we were both presented with opportunities to do so. I wouldn't have left had I not had this opportunity. I would have happily stayed doing the Book of Mormon, but the timing just worked out as such that this another amazing opportunity presented itself, and it all just felt like good timing to sort of leave.
Yeah, you said you felt this sense of ownership. This was the first role that you had originated, because your roles in Hairspray and Jersey Boys, other people had done it first.
Yeah, that's a whole different skill, to walk into a show that exists and try to make it your own as much as possible is that's hard, and it never really feels like it's yours. So to start something from scratch and to do something first that no one else has ever seen, and to be so tied to a role is it's exciting, but it's a little daunting sometimes. You know, are people going to believe me as, you know, something else? Are people going to, you know, accept me as somebody else?
Andrew Rannells will be back in the second half of the show. NBC will show a preview of his new series, The New Normal, tonight. The show premieres tomorrow night. Here's Rannells in another song from the cast recording of The Book of Mormon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You all know the Bible is made of testaments old and new. You've been told it's just those two parts, or only one if you're a Jew. But what if I were to tell you there's a fresh third part out there, which was found by a hip new prophet who had a little Donny Osmond flair? Have you heard of the All-American prophet? The blonde-haired, blue-eyed voice of God. He didn't come from the Middle East like those other holy men. No, God's favorite prophet was All-American. I'm gonna take you back to biblical times, 1823. An American man named Joe living on a farm in the Holy Land of Rochester, New York.
You mean the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith?
That's right, that young man spoke to God.
He spoke to God?
And God said, Joe, people really need to know that the Bible isn't two parts. There's a part three to the Bible, Joe. And I, God, have anointed you to dig up this part three that is buried by a tree on the hill in your backyard.
Wow, God says go to your backyard and start digging. That makes perfect sense.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, with reviews on local contractors and doctors in 500 categories with ratings based only on member feedback. Angie'sList.com. From AMARC Foundation, supporting ProCon.org, giving the pros and cons of issues, including health care and medical marijuana, at ProCon.org. And from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, boats, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles, at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Ed Ward tells us about American Studios, the little-known Memphis studio that had its share of hits in the 60s. Also, Andrew Rannells talks about appearing in the HBO series Girls, growing up, and why, when he came out to his family, no one was surprised. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Andrew Rannells. He stars in the new NBC comedy series, The New Normal, about a gay couple that decides they're ready to have a child, so they hire a surrogate. NBC will preview the entire first episode tonight. Rannells got rave reviews and a Tony nomination for his starring role in the original cast of The Book of Mormon, and he was really funny in his small part in Girls. So you had a great part in the first season of Girls, the HBO series created by and starring Lena Dunham. And I want to play a clip from one of the scenes that you're in. And this, okay. So this is an episode in which she's found out that she has an STD. And she's been told to, like, get in touch with people she's slept with. So you play her former college boyfriend. She hasn't been in touch with you for a while. So, you know, she calls you up, dinner reservations, nice restaurant. She kind of dresses up. She obviously wants to look really attractive. And either she's still maybe carrying the torch a little bit for you, or she's hoping that you're going to be a little jealous that she has a boyfriend. But in that scene, you reveal to her that you're actually gay. And like she is totally unprepared to hear that. So here's her response.
So I'm processing this. Does this mean that the whole time we were together, you were?
Oh, I mean, are you, you're asking, did I always want to have sex with men? Yes. Are you asking, did I think about it when we were together? Yes.
So then how were you able to have sex with me?
Well, there's a handsomeness to you, just...
Oh, all right, God.
That wasn't the right...
Well, I am very, very happy for you.
Thank you. It means a lot to me.
But I do wish that you could have maybe figured this out a little bit sooner, like maybe when we were at liberal arts college, because there were a lot of gay men there.
Okay. Now, I just feel like there's a lot of aggression coming off of you.
And we're just going to fast forward a little deeper into this scene. So here's the rest of the scene.
This is not the time for you to throw stones because you know what? I'm the one who was lied to
by
by you for 2 years.
Well, I think it was Maya Angelou who said we are only as blind as we want to be.
So you're saying that I was supposed to know that you were gay? Because let me tell you something. This fruity little voice that you've put
on. Excuse me?
Is a new thing.
Fruity little voice?
Keep it down.
Is this about the scarf?
It's not about the scarf. The scarf is not helping the situation, but it's about your tone of voice. It's about your mannerisms. And in my
I'm my authentic self. I am being my authentic self.
If you had been this gay in college, I would have known because I have two eyeballs, two ears.
You might want to take some steps back through your other boyfriends. And not for nothing, maybe take a look at your dad.
You didn't just.
I did.
In what way does my father read gay to you?
Well, he has a stud in his ear.
He got it on a trip he took with a bunch of his male friends. I heard what that sounded like.
Are we hearing ourselves?
I heard what that sounded like.
I don't think we are.
You know what I'm going to do from now on?
What are you going to do?
Ask people if they're gay before I have sex with them.
Good luck with that. Good luck with that. And don't be surprised if people ask you if you keep dressing like that.
I'm going to have the last word in this situation.
It was nice to see you.
No.
Your dad is gay.
No.
I've heard that scene so many times. It is so funny. That's Andrew Rannells, my guest, along with Lena Dunham in a scene from her series, Girls. Did you improvise any of that?
We did. We did improvise a lot of that. She was very generous in that sense. I mean, the script was hilarious. And then we did it, you know, several times as written. And Judd Apatow, who was the executive producer of the show, was also on the set that day. And he sort of was feeding us some suggestions about where the conversation might be able to go, including, you know, me telling her that I think her dad is gay and things like that. He would just sort of come over and like whisper little things to each of us. And she's so, I can't say enough good about that lady. She's just, I love Lena a lot. And I think that she's so talented and so generous to work with. And so we just had a lot of fun and she's really fun to play with.
Who came up with that line of like, well, there's a certain handsomeness.
I'm sad to say that that was my own creation. She recently they're gonna release the DVD of the first season, and she and another producer, executive producer Jenny Connor, asked if they could include my audition on the DVD. I think everybody's audition, but my audition was also going to be in there, which included a lot of improvising. And you kind of black out when you audition. You know, I don't remember half the things that I said that day. So it was really terrifying to actually have to, like, sit and watch it because you never see those audition tapes. But I had to sit and watch my audition. And I said that line to her, that she was – there's a handsomeness to her that allowed me to have sex with her. So horrifying. So mean. But yes, that was – sadly, that was my creation.
So you've done three Broadway musicals, The Book of Mormon, Hairspray – and Jersey Boys.
Yes.
Did you grow up wanting to sing on Broadway?
Yeah, that's kind of all I ever wanted to do. at a very early age, I knew I wanted to be an actor, and then more specifically that I wanted to be on Broadway and be in musicals. So I moved to New York right after high school to go to college in Manhattan, and that was always my goal. I wanted to be on Broadway, and I wanted to be a leading man on Broadway, and that was the dream.
Growing up in Omaha, Nebraska, how did you know you wanted to be on Broadway?
Well, I was very fortunate that there's a children's theater right by my house that my grade school took field trips to. So we were at a very young age exposed to live theater. And they had a really great program of acting classes, and you could audition to be in these shows. And so very quickly, I knew that I wanted to be a part of that community. And my parents were, you know, none of my other siblings had done that, but my parents were very supportive of that, I think. Maybe because of its proximity to our home, it was very close, so the extracurricular was easy to get to. But they were always really supportive of it, my family, and so they just encouraged me to kind of keep going. And then that turned into, you know, community theater as I got older, and it turned into like local TV commercials, and it was just always the thing that I wanted to do. And I just was fortunate that I actually got to do it.
My guest is Andrew Rannells. He stars in the new comedy series, The New Normal. NBC will preview the entire first episode tonight. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Rannells, and he stars in the new NBC comedy series, The New Normal. He also starred in the Book of Mormon. Your new series, The New Normal, is about how untraditional families are becoming the new normal. And
yes,
you and your partner are one of those non-traditional families, and you're using a surrogate to try to have a child. So how normal or, quote, abnormal was your family when you were growing up? Or non-traditional, whatever.
I mean, we were very traditional. It's two parents, two heterosexual parents. I have two older sisters, an older brother, and a younger sister. So, you know, the five of us kids and my parents. So we were sometimes, I remember as a kid, you know, going to restaurants, you know, occasionally when we would go out to eat, and like seven people was always like a big deal. I was always aware of the fact that I came from a big family. There's a lot of kids, and how do you do that? And how do you, you know? But mostly it was very traditional. You know, we all went to the same grade school. Now, I think that my family, the thing that sort of separated us was our sense of humor. I think, particularly from my father, ran a little dark. So I think we were raised with a severe sense of sarcasm, which often got us into trouble. But yeah, I think that maybe is the thing that sort of set us apart, that our family were maybe a little more boisterous and a little more irreverent than the other Catholic families in Omaha.
When did you figure out that you were gay?
Kind of immediately. I mean, the earliest memory I have of that, honestly, is watching maybe Clash of the Titans or Grease 2. Watching that and really having like strange feelings about Harry Hamlin and Maxwell Caulfield. And I was, you know, 4 or 5 at the time, and just like having a crush and like, you know, sort of understanding what that was and verbalizing that crush, which I've never really spoken to my family about specifically, but like they were aware of the fact that like at 4, I had a crush on Maxwell Caulfield. Like that was a thing. And not like I wanted to be him, like I wanted to date him, like I wanted to, you know. So I think that they, and you know, so when I came out, when I was like, you know, 18, and I, you know, graduated from high school, and I felt like that was the time to like officially say it, I surprised 0 people in my family. There's not a surprise to be had. No, everybody was well aware of that.
So what did they say, since they already figured that out?
They were all very polite. They were very supportive and said exactly what, you know, and I realize how incredibly lucky I am that I come from a family that it was a non-issue. And particularly because you might think that, okay, so Nebraska, Catholic, like that probably didn't go so well for you. But it really, they were so great and continue to be so great. And it never really, I mean, I remember my dad saying that he believed that it was a choice, but that he also loved me and that he was, you know, he would support me no matter what I chose to do. And then about 6 months later, he said, I've been thinking about this a lot and it clearly is not a choice. This is clearly the way you were born, because as I, you know, replay your childhood in my head, I know that you've been telling us this since you were born. So no, this is not a choice. And I, you know, I love you and I will always love you. So
that must have been great to hear that your father thought it through and changed his mind based on the evidence that he'd seen.
Yeah, he, and it was after I went away to college and I came home for Christmas and he told me very, you know, very plainly that he had been thinking about it a lot since I left. And that was his response to it after that.
So after high school, I think you went briefly to college, but then left for New York, hoping to make it, hoping to, you know, fulfill your dream of getting in a Broadway show, which, of course, you did. But when you got to New York, where did you start?
Well, I went to college. I went to Marymount Manhattan, which was is on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And that was a great introduction to the city. And it was a great safety net to sort of be there. And I went there for 2 years. And at a certain point, I just sort of realized, I guess, that I was, you know, I was going into great debt to get a BFA in acting. And I was like, what is that? What is that going to, what is that even going to be when I'm finished? And what is that going to, so I started, I just started auditioning and I got a couple jobs and I got a, you know, I got an equity card and I joined the union and I dropped out of school and I thought, well, let's just do it. Like if, you know, if I had been really passionate about studying anything else, I completely would have stayed in college and I would have gotten that degree. But the fact that my passion was going to be acting, you know, I was paying for college myself. And I was like, I can't justify going this deep into debt for something that might not mean anything. So I want to just try it. I want to try and see if I'm good enough to do this before I invest any more financially in this. And, you know, luckily I was given the, you know, proper encouragement via jobs that I just sort of, I kept going. But my career, definitely the early years were a little scattershot in terms of, it was a little regional theater, it was a lot of voiceovers, it was a lot of, you know, random day jobs. I mean, it was hard. It was hard to kind of scrap around. And then once Hairspray sort of happened, then it all kind of clicked into place.
Were you ever in a Broadway chorus before getting the lead?
I was. I was in Hairspray. I played the pivotal role of Fender, who is a boy on the show with glasses. That was the kid with glasses. So I was, you know, I was in the ensemble and I understudied 4 different characters. And so that was great. It was a great training, I suppose, in terms of, and also humility. It was a good lesson in humility of how to, you know, be the star one night and then go back to the ensemble the next night and how to do that without any hard feelings.
So I'm going to ask for your honest opinion about the state of the new Broadway musical.
All right. I feel like the Book of Mormon was a really great sort of kick in the pants for Broadway, and I hope that it encourages other writers to come in and experiment with new stories and new scores. You know, having been a part of a original musical based on a film with Hairspray that was a huge hit and very creative and really successful, and then also being part of a huge hit with Jersey Boys, it was a jukebox musical using an existing score. Also, you know, a lot of fun, but I think the really cool part about the Book of Mormon was that it was a brand new story and a brand new score that nobody heard, and I feel like that's fallen out of fashion a little bit, I think, because producers are afraid to take chances on new stories and new scores. But I hope that changes. I hope that there, you know, are more new shows. And I know there are a few this fall that are brand new. I know Chaplin is, you know, it's an original story and an original score. And I wish them luck and I applaud those producers for taking a chance on something that's brand new.
Well, Andrew Rannells, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Such an honor to talk with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Andrew Rannells stars in the new NBC comedy series, The New Normal. A preview of the entire first episode will be shown tonight. The program will have its official premiere tomorrow night. So there's good news for Sondheim fans like Andrew Rannells and me. A new recording of Stephen Sondheim's musical Merrily We Roll Along was recently released. It's from a production that was presented by Encores at New York City Center last February for a limited run. When Merrily opened on Broadway back in 1981, it lasted only 16 performances. Nevertheless, some Sondheim fans consider Merrily one of his best musicals. So here's a song from the new recording of the Encores production of Merrily We Roll Along. This is Not a Day Goes By, performed by Betsy Wolfe, Celia Keenan-Bulger, and Colin Donnell.
Not a day goes by, not a single day, but you're somewhere a part of my life, and it looks like you'll stay. As the days go by, I keep thinking, when does it end? That it can't get much better, much longer, but it only gets better and stronger and deeper and nearer and simpler and freer and richer and clearer. And no, not a day goes by, not a blessed day, but you somewhere come into my life, and you don't go away, and I have to say, if you do, I'll die. Day after day, till the days go by, till the days go by, till the days go
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward has the story of the Memphis-based American Studios that remains obscure in spite of its hits. This is Fresh Air. Memphis has been a music town ever since anyone can remember, and has had places to record that music ever since there have been records. Some of its recording studios, Sun, Stax, and High, are well known, but American Studios, which produced its share of hits, remains obscure. Rock historian Ed Ward has its story.
Today's special is Memphis Soul Stew. We sell so much of this, people wonder what we put in it. We're gonna tell you right now. Give me about a half a teacup of bass. Now I need a pound of fat back drums. Now give me 4 tablespoons of ballin' Memphis guitars. This gonna taste all right. Thank you.
Now just a little pinch of organ. Now give me a half a pint of horn.
King Curtis had it right on his hit Memphis Soul Stew. Each one of the musicians he calls into play had appeared on plenty of iconic Memphis-based hits, recorded where this one was, at American Studios, 827 Thomas Street, a slouchy, windowless one-story building you'd probably walk right past. It had been opened in 1964 by Chips Moman, a musician from Georgia who'd learned engineering and gone to work at Stax Records in its early days, only to lose his job before it really got going. Unlike Stax, Moman's studio wasn't connected to a record label. Anyone was free to use it, which explains why the first hit to come out of American was by a local rock band.
I keep on dancing for
Gentry's Keep On Dancing managed to hit number 4 on the national pop charts in 1965, even though, or maybe because, the lyrics were incomprehensible and the sound was awful. The next year, Moman and his guitarist friend Tommy Cogbill were tapped for a session in Muscle Shoals and met Dan Penn and Spooner Oldham, who were not only studio musicians, but songwriters looking for people to record their songs. Word was getting out that American had some top-notch players, all of whom were white, oddly enough, and this was attracting artists, so Penn and Oldham started hanging around. They must have been paying attention when Gold Wax Records' Quentin Plunch brought his latest discovery in.
I said I wasn't gonna tell nobody else, but I just can't keep it all to myself now. For as long as I've been running around, I finally met a little girl that really got me down now. Baby, you got my mind messed up now. Little girl, you sure got my mind messed up now. I go to bed, Lord, and I can't sleep. Sit down at the table, ooh, Lord, I can't eat that. Somebody please, please help me now. Oh,
James Carr's You Got My Mind Messed Up established him, although today he's best remembered for Dark End of the Street, which Penn and Oldham not only wrote, but Penn sang harmony on. Up in New York, Atlantic Records took notice. They had an uneasy relationship with Stax and were always looking for other Southern studios to record in. In 1967 and 68, most of their top soul stars were at American, and so was another of their artists who was trying to change direction.
Preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gathered around and started talking, Pastor Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard we go walking. Then he'd look into my eyes. Lord knows, to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was. Yes, he was. Being good isn't always easy, no matter how hard I try. When he started sweet talking to me, he'd come and tell me everything is alright. He'd kiss and tell me everything's alright. Can I get away again tonight? The only one who could ever.
Son of a Preacher Man was Dusty Springfield's debut on Atlantic, and it, and the entire album it was on, Dusty in Memphis, was recorded at American. The list of hits cut at American during this period is astonishing. The Letter by the Box Tops, Angel of the Morning by Merrily Rush, Hooked on a Feeling by B.J. Thomas, Skinny Legs and All by Joe Tex and I'm in Love by Wilson Pickett are just a few. But the local seal of approval came in January and February 1969 when Memphis' biggest hitmaker, in serious need of continuing the career revival he'd had with his 1968 television special, rented the studio and the Memphis Boys and had Chips Moman produce an album for him.
That big eight-wheeler rolling down the track, and your true loving daddy ain't coming back. He's a rolling on. You were flying too high from one of those skies on. But someday, baby, when you've had your play, you're gonna want your daddy, but your daddy will say, keep moving on, keep rolling on. You were flying too high, I'm one of those guys, so I'm moving on.
From Elvis in Memphis showed that the King still had it and gave him In the Ghetto, his first top 10 hit in 4 years. Chips Moman always insisted he wasn't a businessman, and by 1972, he'd proven it to everyone's satisfaction. The final blow came when Atlantic didn't renew its contract with American, and Moman sold the place. He, and a lot of the amazing crew of musicians he'd worked with, wound up in Nashville, where they all became indispensable to stars like Waylon Jennings. But American Studios was history.
Ed Ward lives in France. The music he played is from the Ace CD, Memphis Boys, The Story of American Studios. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Heidi Simon is doing our online media. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we're joined by an extraordinarily cute 11-week-old puppy who is about to be trained to do extraordinary work as a search and rescue dog. We talk with the founder of the University of Pennsylvania's new Working Dog Center, Dr. Cynthia Otto. She worked with dogs at Ground Zero. And we'll meet the center's training director, Anne-Marie D'Angelo. Join us.